Okay, everyone, welcome to Section. This is CS50, our very first super section. As you all know, next week, regular sections will start, but this week we're all together. There is myself. My name is Jason. I'm a lecturer in computer science. We have Andy, who's the head TA of CS50, and Skaz, Professor Brian Scazzolotti, who's a professor in computer science. We are the CS50 heads at Yale. You can always email us. heads@cs50.yale.edu. We will be at lectures. We will be at office hours. If there's ever anything we can do for you, anything you need, feel free to reach out to us. So what are we going to do today? Or before then, what's coming up this week? So office hours are Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, 8 to 11. There's a schedule on the website. Sections, like I mentioned, are starting next week, and you'll find out this week what time your section is, what day it is, and who your TA is. Problem set one is due at Thursday at noon, Friday at noon with a late day. Yes, you have 9 late days, and there are 9 problem sets, and you can only use 1 late day per problem set. Yes, in effect, all problem sets are due Friday at noon. That is all the details are on the syllabus. Every Friday we have lunches. We like to make this large course feel a bit smaller, so you're welcome to RSVP free lunch with fellow classmates and staff, cs50.yale.edu/RSVP. All of these things that I have on the screen and more, you can find at cs50.yale.edu or cs50.harvard.edu if you go to Harvard and are watching this online. Also on those websites, there are a ton of resources for you. Every lecture not only has the video of the lecture, but also notes. Somebody will watch the lecture and take notes for you, so you can just pay attention during lectures. Or you can use their notes slash our notes to supplement your own notes. There are slides online, the source code, everything David goes over in lecture or Skaz goes over in lecture, that source code is available online, as well as, like I mentioned, videos. Sections, likewise, will all be filmed. All of those slides will be available. All of that code will be available for you. There are shorts on the website where CS50 staff members spend 5 to 10 minutes going through topics for you. Some of those you've already encountered in problem sets. Office hours, as I mentioned, Mondays through Thursdays, 8 to 11. CS50 Study is a fantastic resource. There are practice problems, sample slides, known bugs that students like to run into for essentially every topic we will cover in this course. And finally, on this slide at least, Reference 50, which gives you information on all of the C functions you could ever possibly hope to use and many, many more. Again, that dot, dot, dot at the bottom of the screen is to indicate that there's even more resources on those two websites, cs50.yale.edu, cs50.harvard.edu. So what are we doing today? Well, first, I'm going to give you a look at the resources. Already did that one. Look at us. Now we're going to go over data types and operators in C. Then Andy will come up here and go over libraries in C, printf, a function with which you are already familiar or will quickly become very familiar. And you will also go over conditionals and loops. And then finally, Skaz will go over the CS50 IDE, if you have not dove in already in problem set one, as well as how to use the terminal and useful commands, and then give you some demos and practice coding in the CS50 IDE. Before I jump in to this content on this slide, does anybody have any questions so far? Great. Okay. Changing gears. That was me shifting gears in a manual car. So data types. In C, you cannot just have a variable x and have it be on line 10, an integer, maybe the number 1, on line 20, a decimal number, 10.5, and then a couple lines later, a string, I love CS50. In C, variables can only be one thing and one thing only. And so you have to give them types. And on this board, we have a list of types. There are chars, or which stand for characters. So that's one letter, A, B, C, D. That can also be a space, or that can also be a new line character. There are integers, which are just numbers, whole numbers, or integers rather, but no decimals. For decimals, we have floating point numbers. Floating point numbers are numbers with decimals. Then there are longs, which are essentially longer integers. You'll notice that a long is 8, whereas an int is 4. I'll get to that in a second. But that's because longs can store even more integers than an int can store. Double is a long float. And finally, we have string, which is a type that you have probably used before. If you include, hashtag include cs50.h in your source file, then you can use a string type. It's not actually built into C. There are a couple other types as well, but these are the principal ones with which you will use and encounter. C, as again I mentioned, every variable it can only be one type and one type only. That's because C is a statically typed language as opposed to dynamically typed languages, where if you create a variable, you can change what's stored in it as you go on in your program. Over here on the right-hand side, I have the different sizes of these types of data in bytes. So a character is 1 byte. That's 8 bits. And that means there, because 8 bits, there's 8 zeros and 1s. We saw those demos in the first week with that binary bulbs. With 8 bits or 1 byte, we can represent numbers from 0 to 255. Right? If all 8 bits are 0, that's 0. If the first bit is 1, that's the number 1, and so on, all the way up to 255. And that's why for characters, you can have essentially up to 255 of them, but that's plenty to cover all the characters we need to use. For integers, you can have you have 0, and then you have 2 to the 32 minus 1. Those are how many options you have for integers. For a long, you have 0 to 2 to the 64 minus 1. So you have many, many more options for longs. Strings, that's a question mark, because that's a cliffhanger for later. Yeah, I could tell everybody's on the edge of their seat. Like, what's that question mark? It's a cliffhanger. We'll eventually cover the size of strings and talk more about strings, because string is actually one of the training wheels we put on in this course at the beginning and then take off later on, because strings in C are actually pointers to character arrays. But again, that's a cliffhanger for later. Before I move on, any questions, comments, concerns about this slide? Okay, I must be a fantastic explainer. Also, when you're programming, you're going to use these operators, really simple signs that can do simple operations with which you're probably already very familiar. For example, on the right-hand side, we see add. To add, you just do a plus sign. And so you might have two variables, x and y. You can do x plus y in your code. Maybe you want to say you have the number 7 and 3. You want to store that in a variable called sum. You can do int for the type, space sum, the name of the variable, equals 7 plus 3, semicolon. What would that store in sum? Anyone? If I had int sum equals 7 plus 3, what would be stored in sum? You can just shout it out.
10.
That's exactly right. What about int sum equals 7 minus 3? I just used that dash sign. What's going to be stored?
4.
Sum is probably the wrong name for that variable, but 4 would be stored. To multiply in C, you use the little star character. You don't use an X. To divide, you use a forward slash, not the division symbol. And to modulo, you use the percent symbol. So let's say int z equals 7 modulo 3. What would be stored in z? Does anybody, that's essentially asking, what does modulo do? Does anybody know what modulo does? Yeah. Why 4? It is the remainder when you divide. So 7 divided by 3 is 2 remainder 1. So 1 would be stored. You did subtraction, but that's how it works. That's what the modulo operator does. It takes a number, divides it by another number, and returns to you the remainder. So again, 7 modulo 3 gives you 1, because 7 divided by 3 is 2 remainder 1, and it returns the remainder. What about, let's go back up one step to that division sign. If I did 7 divided by 3, does anybody know what that would return? Why 2 and not 2.33333? So that's exactly right. In C, if you do division of two integers, 7 divided by 3, it gets the answer, which in this case is 2.33333 forever, and it finds that decimal point and chops everything off after the decimal, and it just returns you 2. So if I did 8 divided by 3, that actually, we know that to return 2.666, but it chops everything off of the decimal, truncates it all, and just returns to you 2. So 6 divided by 3, 7 divided by 3, 8 divided by 3 are all going to return to you 2. Does anybody know or have a guess as to how I could actually get the full answer if I want that decimal? Yeah, go ahead. What do you mean? Right, so if that's exactly right. 7 is an integer, but if I do if I wanted to turn that into a floating point number, I would have to store that as 7.0, because the computer is really stupid. We saw with that with the PB&J example. It'll only do exactly what you tell it. So if you write 7, it thinks that's an integer. If you write 7.0, even though we know those things are equivalent, it treats that like a floating point number. So if you did 7.0 divided by 3 or divided by 3.0, it would say, okay, now we're dealing with floats. I will return to you 2.333333333 forever, but not really forever, because as we saw also in lecture, these floating point numbers aren't exactly precise. So if you do want that decimal or part of that decimal, then you have to use one of them has to be a floating point number, and the computer has to understand that this is a floating point you're dealing with, not an integer. Any questions on that table on the right-hand side so far? Or your left-hand side? Your left-hand side. Yeah?
So you would write, if we're just a regular integer, you would write, and would you have to write floats?
Yeah, so, if you want to create a variable that's a float, you need to say float z equals something.
Okay.
But if I wanted to do 7 divided by 3 and get that decimal, I would do float z equals 7.0 divided by 3.0 semicolon. And that would give me the floating point number.
Okay.
If I did something like int z equals 7 divided by 3, that would give me an integer, because those are all integers. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Any other questions about that table? Oh, really? I'm so excited. Okay. So some other things you will use oftentimes in conditions or loops are these types of operators, these types of Boolean expressions. And as we learned, equals equals is what you use to check if two things are equal. So here I'm checking if x equals equals y. Let's again assume that x is 7 and y is 3. So if I wrote 7 equals equals 3, what would that return to me? Is that true or false? Okay, I feel like everybody can get this one. So everybody, what would that return?
False.
False, great. 7 does not equal 3, so 7 equals equals 3 would return false. You do have a not equal sign, so if I checked 7 does not equal 3, what would that return?
True.
True. Excellent. Somebody was very emphatic in the back, and I appreciate that. Then you have less than operator, less than or equal to operator, greater than operator, greater than or equal to operator. So one more sanity check. If I had 7 is greater than or equal to 3, what would that return?
True.
True. Yes. Ah, that back room, back side of the room, fantastic. You can combine these expressions, if you would like as well, with a logical AND, which is ampersand, ampersand, or a logical OR, which is pipe, pipe, bar, bar. And so now you can test two things together. Is that funny? Is that funny? So if I wanted, I could say, is 7 greater than 3? And 2 is less than 4. Well, 7 is greater than 3, that's true. 2 is less than 4, that's true. So this whole thing would return true. If I tested 7 is greater than 3, and I'm just picking random numbers here, 4 is less than 2, well, that's false. So true and false make false. And you can go on, and you combine as many conditions together as you'd like. Does anybody have any questions, comments, concerns so far? And I see some of you taking pictures of me in the screen, which I appreciate. Hopefully it's not Snapchat, hopefully it's for your notes. But all these are gonna be available online, so you don't have to take pictures of this. We have, like I mentioned, everything will be available online for you. Okay, I'm about to get off stage. So does anybody wanna say anything before that happens? Questions? Oh, stop, you guys are too nice. All right, I'm gonna tag out.
Okay.
Let's go.
We're gonna do an awkward mic change now.
Let me take this off.
Appreciate the support, guys. All right. Can you hear me? Is that good? Perfect. Beautiful. Let me just tuck that in. Okay. So, I'm about to do like a giant information dump on you guys right now, and no worries whatsoever if you're not following like every little line of what I'm about to show you. As Jason said, everything is completely online. Just we're gonna try to introduce everyone to the concepts covered in some of these slides. So just follow along, no worries if you don't understand everything. However, if at any point you feel lost, raise your hand, we'll stop, no worries. Cool. So I think something that David has already kind of mentioned in lecture and Jason has kind of alluded to today is what a library is. So in programming, we have these data, we have these things called libraries, where essentially all they are is just a set of functions that is essentially just code that's already been written by somebody else that we can all use within our programs. So like how does like a normal library work, right? Like you enter the library door, you like have all these books you can pull out, and then you can access information within those books, right? Same thing in programming. You have a library that has already been written by other people, and the way that you can, as a programmer, can or a student can gain access to that library is through hashtag include. So for example, in C, we have the most commonly used 3C standard libraries, the input-output library, the string library, and the math library. So within your first couple problem sets, those will be the three that you're primarily using. So as David already explained in lecture, the standard IO library, or the standard input-output library, does exactly that. It allows you in your code to input anything from the user and output that to the screen, essentially printing it to the screen. And so anytime you use any functions, for example, the function printf, which we're going to go over in the next slide, make sure to include the standard IO library, or else you're not going to be able to use the printf function, because you as the programmer never actually wrote that function. You're just kind of using somebody else's code within your own code. Does that make sense to everybody? Cool. And then we eventually get onto the string.h library and the math.h library. .h just signifies library. Other libraries that you'll eventually be using within your code. However, for purposes of this library, we also have, of this class, we also have what is called the CS50 library, CS50.h, where we, for your perusal, have created many important and useful functions so that you as a programmer can kind of piggyback off of what we've kind of already written, so that there's functions available to you for your use. I'll be covering a couple of the functions commonly used, but know that these are all Googleable online. Feel free, pull up the CS50 library, and then you have all the functions there. Yeah.
So if we weren't using the software that is provided to us by the class, does that mean we'd have to download and find like this header file ourselves and tell the computer where it is?
Great question, exactly. So it's like if you're not physically present at like a library, there's no way for you to like actually go and access it. So same thing with programming in C. You have to make sure that you're using our appliance because the library has already been incorporated into it. And then when you hashtag include, the library is there. Yeah, good question. Everyone good? All right, so we're going to hit essentially what is the first function that we as programmers are going to be using within our code. This is called the printf function. So printf function, as I've already said on the last slide, is included in the standard IO, standard input-output library. So make sure whenever you're using, let me grab a laser pointer. Whenever you're using the printf function, you have to include the standard IO library, or else, you know, when you compile, you're going to get an error because the computer's going to be like, oh, I don't know where printf is. You're not telling me where printf is. Well, printf is included in standard IO. So when you use printf, make sure to have that line above your code. So for example, printf here is a function. All it does is print out something inside the parentheses to the user. Would anybody like to take a stab at what this line of code right here is going to print out? Hint, the answer is on the screen. Anyone? Verdi, why don't you go ahead and say the whole statement?
Hello, my name is Andy, and I'm 20 years old.
Ah, lovely. So in this line, we're going to print out, hello, my name is Andy, and I'm 20 years old, which is, in fact, a true statement. Syntax. So a couple of syntactic issues that you guys want to make sure you know. Quotes, double quotes. Tell the computer that everything inside is going to be printed. Everything inside can just be exactly how you type it, except for commonly at the end, we're going to want to include a dash n. So a dash n, does anyone want to take a guess at what that does to our code? Yeah.
It's on a new line.
Exactly. So all this does is allow whatever happens after this statement to be printed to a new line so that, you know, when you're writing your code, you don't randomly have things tacked onto the end that you don't want. That everything gets neatly printed, one line, and then we start on the following line. Yeah. Does anyone remember what that semicolon does. One more, Cody. Yeah? Sorry? Yeah. So in C or any programming language, the semicolon denotes the end of a programming line. So for example, like in English, we use period to say, oh, this is the end of a sentence. In programming, same thing, we have a semicolon to denote the end of a line. Oftentimes, when you're starting to program, you'll realize you forget to add a semicolon, and then you try to run your code and it doesn't work, and you're like, ah, I don't know why it should be working. Chances are you probably forgot a semicolon or a bracket or something somewhere. So that's important to remember. Cool. All right, show of hands, how many people here have ever taken AP Computer Science or programmed in Java before ever? Okay, lovely. That will not be applicable then. But in Java, you have something called system.out.println, which does not exist in C. So in C, whenever you want to add in variables into anything you want to print out, there's a specific syntax we're going to use that's called the placeholding. Essentially, we add placeholders in place of the integer or the valuable or the variable that we want to print. So as you guys can see, we've included a new library header file here, the CS50 library. And contained within that CS50 library is a common function we'll be using in our course called getInt. Does anybody want to take a stab at what getInt may possibly be doing? Maddie, do you? Anyone?
It prompts you for an integer.
Exactly. So this function, another function that's already been written by somebody else that we can call upon now, all it does is prompt the user, to input whatever you want as the code is running, and it stores whatever. In this case, we're getInting, so that means we're obtaining an integer, and we're going to store that in another integer that we've just made called age. Does that make sense to everybody? Cool. So now that we've stored this integer that we've prompted from the user in this variable we've created of type int called age, we can go ahead and place that in our printf function. So the syntax usually for printf is that wherever in your actual physical line you want to include that integer, you do that symbol right there, the percent symbol, with the type of variable that you want. So in this case, age is an integer, so you're going to include percentage I because it's an integer. And then after your statement, you're going to do comma and the name of the variable. So here, we're going to print out, hello, my name is Andy, and I am blank years old. Comma age with whatever I input. So if I were to input 20 for my getInt here, it would print out the exact same thing. But if I wanted to input something else, like perhaps 40 or 45, then you would see that reflected accordingly in the code. So this is an example of something in which like it prints out and it looks to you as if it's the same thing, but underneath the hood of the computer, there's actually very different things happening. Cool. All right, so what if we want multiple variables? Pretty easy, same thing. We also have a new function here called getString, also included within the CS50 library, that all it does is prompt the user for a string, which is just a set of characters. So like a sentence or like a name. So in this case, we would have two placeholders, percentage s for string and percentage I for integer. And we're going to follow that by the two variables we want included in the order that they appear in the sentence. So for example, my name is blank. I want a name there. So I'm going to have the name first. And then afterwards, I want age. I'm going to have age second. And so if I wanted to input, hello, my name is Andy, and I'm 20 years old, if I inputted Andy and 20, the exact same thing would print. However, now we've got two stored variables of name as well as int. Yeah?
Would the code be able to run if you switch name and age at the end of that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So long story short, no. Because name and age, what type of variable is name?
String.
And what type of variable is age? So here we have a placeholder for string and integer, right? So if you were to switch these, the computer is not going to know. It's going to check for a string. And if you try to give an int, it's going to be like, wait, I'm confused. You told me I should be allotting memory for like an int. And right here, when it expects an integer and you give it a name and a string instead, it's also going to be very confused and it won't run exactly the way you need it. So here, naming and syntax is very important for running code. Everyone good? Yeah, Maddie.
Here, I know we've looked at examples in class where it's like
they ask, like, what is your age? What is your name?
Mm-hmm.
Here, would that be, like, it doesn't, if we were to run this code, yeah. it wouldn't ask for that, but you would just, like, input two numbers, and then it would run that?
Yeah, exactly. So if you wanted for it to display, like, please enter your age, you can just add a printf function that says, please enter your age. I love it. That's a good question. Yeah. No, it actually is not. So all this does is just prompts an empty screen to the user to input something. If you wanted to print out something that tells the user, like, please give me, like, your age, then you would have to printf that yourself. Because everyone uses this function for different things. You could be storing age, you could be storing address, you could be storing phone numbers. And so it's really up to your guys' individual uses for what you want it to say. Yeah. As in, like, the user?
Yeah, like,
okay.
How do I make it, like, where do I put Andy and where do I put Andy?
Yeah, so if you were to actually run this code, I'm not actually running the code, this is just here right now. If I were to run the code, I would compile the code, make the file, run the code, and then there would just be two spaces for me to input it.
Okay.
Yeah, you guys will see when you play around with code yourself. Cool. All right. We're going to move into the next section of what we'll be covering today. We're going to go over what conditional statements are. So if you guys remember and recall from lecture, conditional statements, all they are a set of instructions to the computer in which if a certain condition is true, you execute the code inside of that condition. So in Scratch, essentially the big theme from today is that you guys have already all seen the logic behind everything we're covering, and all we're doing is translating something that was very intuitive in Scratch and hard coding it into the syntax we'll be using for the class, which is C. So logically, all this block was is that piece of code right there. Yeah. Okay. We also get into an if-else statement, which is just an added layer of complexity to the if statement, where the computer takes a look at this and sees if this condition is true, do whatever is inside these two brackets, else, so kind of like the default, if it doesn't meet the condition, do this. It's like a fork in the road, you know, if it's raining outside, I put on a rain jacket. Else, anything else, I don't put on a rain jacket. Does that logic make sense to everybody? Cool. All right, so like a hard example of this that we would see in C is if I wanted to create a variable called homework hours. And if homework hours is less than 5, I say life is great, it's wonderful. However, say the struggle is real, which is what we all on this Monday afternoon up Science Hill are probably doing right now. The way we would, thank you for that. The way we would hard code this in C is if, let's assume we already have a variable of type int called homework hours right here. If homework hours is less than 5, printf, life is great. Remember, keep the dash n because you want like a new line after. Else, print, the struggle is real. Does everyone understand how I transitioned from this block into this block of code? Cool. All right. So now we're going to take a look at multiple if statements altogether. So let's assume the purpose of this program was we prompt the user for a grade. You know, we prompt using getInt for a grade, and they input a value, and you want to display what type of grade they got. So if I were to design a program, I mean, typically in all of our eyes, like, you know, 90 to 100 is like an A, 80 to 90 is like a B, and so forth and so on. What is wrong with this piece of code that it's not doing what I want it to do? Yeah.
They have lower limits, but they don't have upper limits.
Exactly. Did everybody hear what she said? There's going to be upper limits, but no lower limits. Sorry, other way around. Lower limits, no upper limits. So would you like to take a stab at saying what would be printed on this screen if I were to run this code?
An error?
Mm-hmm. Great guess, not quite right. Does anybody have another stab? Yeah, Aaron?
When you put in something greater than 90, it would show all the grades you got. It would show you got an A, you got a B, you got a C.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if, that'd be wonderful. However, they are mutually exclusive, I think. If I were to run this piece of code, and let's just say I inputted the grade of 95. So 95 is now stored in the int called grade. And so C is a language that runs up top to bottom. So it's going to always run up to bottom. So it's going to come here, read if grade is greater than or equal to 90, print f, you got an A. great, I have a 95, that's greater than 90. It's gonna print, I got an A. It's gonna take a look at this if. It's gonna say, well, 95 is also greater than 80. It's gonna print, you also got a B, or a B, exclamation mark, and so on and so forth. So as we can all see, this is a common bug that may occur when we're writing code, to look out for. Anyone, any questions on why that was happening? Great. Okay, so how do we fix this is obviously the logical next question. Well, we have these beautiful things called if, else if, else if, else statements. So, and see, if you wanted to change that problem, you wanted to make each of the conditions mutually exclusive, you would add an else if statement. And these, of course, think of them as like ladders, or like rungs on a ladder. You can add as many of these as you want for as many conditions as you want. So here, if I inputted grade to be 95, if grade is greater than 95, printf, I got an A. Great. It's going to see an else if, and it's going to know, oh no, I already executed the first elf. I know the first if. I know that I don't have to look at any of these because one of them has already been true. So it's going to run from top down. As soon as the first one is true, that it's going to skip over all of the rest of the else ifs. Does that make sense? So in this way, you have kind of different levels of checking. And as soon as one of them is false, the rest are also, they won't even check. Cool. All right. So this is an example of a different sort of conditional statement. We see less often, but we'll see them and use them. And they're often more efficient for certain cases. So we have what's called a switch statement. So before we covered what's like an elf statement, an if-else statement, here we have what are called switch statements. So when do we use switch statements is the key. So in a switch statement, you usually you can only input integers for your variable that you're checking. So if I wanted to check to see if a certain number, for example, a grade, if I got like a 90, I wanted to see if that's an A, B, or C, I can have a case here. However, the case has to be another constant. So in this sense, the switch statement can only check for equality of two numbers. It doesn't check for anything else. So that's something to be very careful of when you're using this. So here, if I wanted to check to see if my grade of 90 is equal to 90 or 80 or 70 or 60, and then print the corresponding grade, I'd be able to write that in a switch statement. So it's going to come here, check, is this integer equal to this constant? If not, it's going to skip. Is it equal to constant 2, and so on and so forth, until you hit the default if none of them are equal. As soon as one of them is said to be equal, it's going to do this line of code and break, which means it's going to hit that run, break, and just completely skip to the bottom of the code. So in that sense, it kind of functions like an if, else if, else if statement. Yeah. So here's like a concrete example for you guys. So let's assume that I wanted to create a variable called year founded. And I want to prompt the user to input the year that their school was founded. So I can create a switch statement here. And let's just say I input 1636. This code here is going to see switch year founded, which equals 1636. It's going to see case 1636. Oh, those are equal. Printf, shouldn't you be at that school up north? Because we assume they don't go here. They go to Harvard. Break and skip to the end. If I were to input 1701, which I assume all of us would input, it would skip this case, come down to case 2, which is 1701, and print, welcome to Yale. Break, skip to the end. Else, you probably are taking this course online, in which case, awesome, welcome to Yale. It's going to go to the default print, hello, internet, and break. Yeah.
Can you use else instead of default there?
No, because the way that this whole function, switch, is built, the syntax you need to use is case, case, default. It's like the if, else, if. This one, it's case, case, default. Yeah, you can have as many cases as you want. Think of it as just like infinitely adding on.
If you switch 1701 with 1636, it doesn't really make a difference, right? It's just going to be checked.
That's a really good question, and we'll touch upon this later. But just know that the switch statement is it's more efficient than an if-else-if because it operates using a different type of function that allows you to essentially just jump straight to the case you need to be at. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. No. So that's what's limiting about the switch statement is that you have to have constants only integers. Yeah. Okay. So this is something that you guys will encounter less often of, but I just wanted to introduce it in case. We have here what's called a ternary operator. where essentially it's just like an if statement compiled into one line. Here, I'll go on to the next line, the next page, because it's easier to see. So we've all seen this, right? This is pretty easy to follow. If I wanted to make a variable called string named s, if a certain number I give it is less than 100, I want to assign low to the string, else I want to assign high. This here is doing the exact same thing those like 8 lines of code are doing. So here I want to create a variable called string, and this is the condition I'm checking. If a number is less than 100, then you assign the value of low, else assign the value of high. These slides will be online. No worries if you guys like don't get this down. This is just a simpler way, more efficient way of writing code. Okay, so now we're going to enter what are, for most people, like a very, very confusing thing to think about at first, the loop section. So today we're going to talk about 3 types of loops. We're going to start with a while loop and talk about a do while loop, and then talk about for loops. So essentially, for the more visual learners out there, we have essentially a graphical depiction of what a while loop does. So in a programming, you would begin and enter the loop at a certain point. You check a condition, and if the condition is true, you execute the code inside, and you come back around and you check. If it's still true, you keep running this code around and around in a loop. However, the second that the condition becomes false, you're going to break and end the loop. And this is essentially the syntax you're going to use. While a certain condition is true, do this. If it's not true, you're going to skip to the end and move forward with your program. Does anyone have an example on what may potentially happen if I try to run this piece of code? By the way, SAJ, that's Skaz, Andy, Jason. We'll sign off our emails. Love, SAJ. That's us. Okay. Anyone have an example or have an idea on what this would print? Kind of a trick question. Okay. So here, remember the condition we're checking for is while true. So while this is true, it's going to print I love SAJ. Is there any point in which we change this to anything otherwise? No, right? So in here, we have encountered what's probably going to be bugging a lot of your programs, the infinite loop. You'll find that if you run this piece of code, it's just going to keep printing I love SAJ. While we appreciate the support, we don't want your computers to crash because you keep printing I love SAJ. So please, please avoid the infinite loop, because it's never going to evaluate to false. And you're never going to leave the loop. And you're going to be sucked in forever. Cool. Okay, the second type of loop we'll talk about today is the do while loop. And it's called a do while loop because you have a do and a while. So this is pretty similar to a while loop, but a little bit different. Here, you're going to do whatever's inside of this while a certain condition is true. So if I were C and I was the computer, I'm running down this piece of code, I take a look at the top, I go to C, I see do this thing. And then I check while this is true, I have to repeat it. But while this is false, then I move forward. And I never go back to that loop again. Can anybody take a stab at like what the difference between this loop and the one we just looked at was practically? Yeah.
The condition comes after before.
Exactly. So she said the condition comes after, not before. Ultimately, the difference between this and the while loop is that you're just going to do whatever's inside this regardless of whether or not your condition is true, and then check the condition. So in this case, you're like always making sure whatever's inside runs at least once before checking to see if you want it to run again. And here is an example of when we would use it. So for example, if I wanted to have a variable of type int named age, and I want to prompt the user for their age, I'm going to do printf, what is your age? Age equals get int, which is prompting the user. And some people will be really annoying, and you know, you don't want bugs in your program of somebody inputting like, oh, I'm -4 years old or whatever. In which case, if they do that, this evaluates to true, which means that I'm going to have to keep going back and doing this. So this is going to keep reprompting the user to give you like a real age number, and it's going to keep going back and redoing it until they give you a real age greater than 1, or not 0. Yeah. So hint, hint, this will be very, very useful for one of your PSET problems. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yep. No, no worries.
Are there different rules here, or did you just forget to put the quotation at the line?
Oh, yeah, sorry. That's totally my bad. That was definitely supposed to be a quotation. Good catch. That would have not run. Yep. Okay. So the last type of loop we'll talk about, and ultimately kind of the most complex, is the for loop. Don't worry if you don't know what that means. It's like pretty confusing at first. We'll go over an example. All that happens in a for loop is that you have three statements that you're going to include. So for a certain thing, you're going to initialize a variable, you're going to add the condition to which this loop will keep running, and then at the end of the loop, you're going to update it. You're going to update the variable that you want to keep track of. So we typically use for loops for when we want to run like a loop for a certain amount of times, and we already know, I want this loop to execute like 10 times. Then you're going to do, I'll go over an example on the next page. Yeah, so here, for example, like in Scratch, if you wanted something to repeat 10 times, all you had to say was repeat 10 times, I love SAJ, which is a more acceptable show of support for us rather than the infinite loop. Here, how you would kind of transition to see and write that is for int, I'm going to create or declare a variable of type int named I. I'm going to initialize it to 0, so I equals 0, semicolon. And this is going to be my condition. So I is less than 10. And then at the end, the last statement you're going to have is the update of what happens to the variable I at the end of your for loop. So it's kind of confusing because different parts of this line are happening at different types of the loop. But I'll go over a pseudocode example that maybe explains this a bit better. Okay, so here, that's the loop we just saw. Essentially, in pseudocode, what is happening in this program is first I'm creating I, initializing it to 0. I'm checking to see if I is less than 10, in which case the first time it is because 0 is less than 10. Thus, the loop is going to run. And then I'm going to print this line. And then at the end of this line, right here, I'm going to do increment I. I plus plus, all that means is incrementing it by 1. So I is now 1 because it was once 0. If I increment it, it's now 1. And then I'm going to go back to the beginning of the loop and I check the condition. Is the condition still true? Yes, 1 is still less than 10. So it's going to print this again, go, and then increment I and check the condition continuously until you eventually get to the point where I is 10. You're going to print this 10 times, and then I is going to equal to 10. You're going to check the condition, is 10 less than 10? No, that is false. Thus, this loop is not going to run, it's going to break, and you're going to continue on with your code. So as you guys can see, this is a really great example of, you know, a loop you can program in that runs for a specified amount of times. Everyone clear? Yeah.
If I wanted to like increment exponentially, is it different coding?
You can, we'll go over this in the next slide. Good question. Yeah. Is anyone, before I move on, anyone at all confused? Because this is like a really tough concept. No worries if you're, okay. All right, just a general slide. This while loop is doing the exact same thing the for loop was. It's just written differently. You guys can peruse the slides at your convenience later on, but just know that there's multiple ways of writing the same thing to happen with different loops. Okay, so now we get into the question of what if we have a loop inside of a loop? We're getting into like real inception type stuff here. You have like, when you want to do things multiple times inside of other things that do things multiple times, you want what's called a nested for loop. For those of you who first see this and get very confused, all we're doing here is having a for loop where we have a variable of row. But inside of it, we also have another for loop of a variable called column. And I highly suggest all of you who are confused to first keep track, draw this out. Don't try to just kind of reason through it, draw it out. You know, in your head, on a piece of paper or whatever, write row, keep track of what row is equal to, write column, keep track of what column is equal to, and keep track of what is printing out with every iteration. Every iteration of this loop, every iteration of the larger loop, just keep following the logic. And I guarantee you, you'll love what you see because it's also very applicable for your problem sets. Cool. All right, so the most important thing that you guys are probably all thinking about right now are your problem set ones, which are due Thursday/Friday. In your water.c program, hint, you're going to have to prompt the user for an input. Within your Mario.c program, you're going to have to use a nested for loop, which is a for loop inside of a for loop, to print a block of pyramid, essentially like what Mario has to jump through. And then inside your greedy, or perhaps making change, if any of you guys ever heard of that, you're going to have to be very careful of first floating point values. Remember, floating decimals and integers are not the same thing. Keep track of which one is which. And you're going to use conditional statements as well. All right, last thing, I've got a couple minutes left. Style. So this is something that doesn't actually affect like the efficiency or like the actual running of your code. However, it affects us as your graders, as your readers, and affects yourself if you're trying to find a problem. It affects all, it kind of affects the readability of your code. So style, like when you're trying to style like an essay, right, for English, if you didn't have paragraphs, you had everything kind of jumbled together on one line, it makes it really difficult for anybody to read your essay, right? Even if your points are logically sound. Same thing in programming, like you can have horribly obscure code, which SCAS will cover, and it can still run and function. But for us, as your lovely TAs who will be reading and evaluating your PSETs, that's not very nice. So please, for the sake of us and yourself, when you're trying to fix a problem in your code and you're trying to read your own code, make sure you follow like some conventions that we're going to go over. So first, give your variables meaningful names. If you want to store an integer called age, please name it age. Don't name it like height when you're trying to store an age and height. It makes everything very confusing for us. We don't like to be confused. You don't like to be confused. No one likes to be confused. If you're going to create something, name it something meaningful. However, in for loops, single character variables are usually fine. Like in for loop, if you want just I and J, K, feel free to just do that. Consistent initialization. So what does that mean? That means technically, theoretically, you can initiate and create multiple variables on the same line. So for example, I can create an integer called SCASAge and an integer called AndyAge equals 20 and an integer called JasonAge on the same line. And I can also assign only one of them and not the others to values. We ask you, please don't do that. Because here you've essentially created three variables, but only one of them actually has a value. And then when we're trying to read your code, or if you're trying to fix a problem in your code, it's very confusing to follow. So just like for your readability, for our readability, don't do that. Okay. Consistent curly braces. Some people like to put their curly braces in different places. It doesn't really matter. Just make sure you're consistent in your own code on where you like to put them. Consistent spacing. If you like put a space after a for loop, always do that. Don't just like kind of do it at some places. Don't do it in others. Just be consistent. Secondly, if anybody would like to peruse the CS50 style guide, we officially have like a style guide that tells you all of these conventions plus more. It's online. It's like cs50.net/style or something like that. You can Google it. Consistency is key. So don't worry what other people are doing. Just make sure that you are consistent within your own code. Anyone have any questions about that? Yeah. So I rarely have this happen, but if you wanted to, if you wanted to be like saving space in your code or whatever, you can do this. We ask that you just don't initialize like one thing and not the others. So if you want to do int scasAge, comma, int AndyAge, comma, int JasonAge, comma, that's fine. Just don't like initialize one and not the others is all. Yeah. Questions? All right. I'm going to pass off the microphone and the laser pointer and the baton to SCAS at this point. It's awkward.
Thank you. How's that for sound? Sound is good? Excellent. Okay. So hi, everyone. I'm going to try to work through a practical example with you. And we're going to use CS50's development environment, what's called the integrated development environment. And you've seen this demonstrated in lecture, and in problem set one, you're going to have an opportunity to use it and play around with it and get accustomed to it, because we're going to use it through the rest of the semester. So in this IDE, you have what looks like a very traditional file browser over on one side. You've got a portion up top where you're going to see your source code, your C file, the code that you write. And down bottom, you'll have a terminal window, which you'll be using to both compile your program and to run or execute your program. Okay. So just to give us a little bit of foundation, in that terminal window, you're going to be using a set of commands that are standard commands throughout most of Unix or Linux systems. And so if you've ever used any form of Unix, Ubuntu, or any of the other flavors, these are going to look familiar. If you haven't, don't worry. There's nothing complicated about them. They're just using a different syntax, a different naming convention than you've seen before. So to list out the files within a particular directory, you're going to use a command called ls, list. If you want to see everything with all the details, you'll use a command line argument with ls-l, and that'll show you everything in more detail, including the permissions for a file. To change directory, you'll use the cd command, and you'll be able to change directory both to go to your home directory, that's just cd all by itself. Cd with two dots will return you up one level to your previous directory. And you can also cd to a subdirectory by typing in cd and the name of that subdirectory. You can also create new directories. And we're going to walk through this in just a minute, but just to put everything on the screen so that you can see them. You'll also have the ability to manipulate files directly from the command line. You'll be able to copy them, to move them, or to remove them, that is effectively to delete them. The CS50 IDE gives you the full power of command line arguments, and that means you can also do highly dangerous things, okay? For example, you can remove, or that is delete, a file without asking for a confirmation, and you can even remove recursively, that's the dash R flag, an entire subdirectory and all of its contents. Okay? They're listed in red because you should think danger every time you see those things. Okay? All right. Now, finally, the things that are going to be really valuable to you are there are a few good tricks to know as you're navigating through this terminal window. First, you can clear the screen at any time by just typing in clear. And you're going to see me do that quite often. You can also just display the text of a file by typing more and then the file name. You'll then be able to scroll back and forth with that just with the spacebar and arrow keys. If you have, as we did today in lecture, a program that is running continuously, an infinite loop, you can stop that program from executing by typing in control, that is holding down control and pressing C. And you may have to do this multiple times. The computer gets far ahead of you and you sometimes need to give it a couple of tries before it'll actually come through. You'll also be able to sort through the commands that you just typed using the up key, arrow key, and then the down arrow key. And what's most useful is instead of typing out long file names, you'll be able to use tab to autocomplete a few instructions. Now we're going to demonstrate all of those in just a second, so if you don't remember them, don't worry. These are things that you'll pick up and use as we go along. Okay, so in C, unlike in Scratch, C is a compiled language. That means we're going to take a source file, that's the text that you write, the commands that you write, the printf statements, the loops, everything else, and we're going to take that file and hand it off to a program called the compiler. The compiler will then take that text that you've written and translate it into the binary instructions that your computer is actually going to use. That's called the object or the executable file. If you look at this file, you're going to see the code that you've written. If you look at this file, you're going to see a random sequence of characters that make no sense whatsoever. That's because this is the binary. It's not meant for you to be reading. However, anytime you want to run something, what you're going to be running is this object file. Okay. So when we work with these files, we'll write a file in C. We'll then compile it using a command like make, which will invoke the compiler clang for the C language. And that'll produce an object file like aout, or in this case, the name, my file that I've put in. All right. So let's actually try this. So I came up with an example of what I wanted to try. And one of the things that fascinates me is animation. So we're going to try to do a little bit of animation using just ASCII characters, characters we can print out easily now. So here is my best attempt at creating for you the animation of a bunny running through the tall grass. There he is. Okay, so he's not running yet, but he's standing there in the tall grass. Now, if I were an animator in the old school version of animation, what I would do is I would produce a picture of this bunny in the grass, And then I would produce another picture, another what they called cell, that had the bunny only slightly moved, and then a third one that had the bunny moved a little bit further. And I would produce an entire sequence of these cells. Some where the bunny is over on to the left-hand side and then moves slowly one by one toward the middle and then from the middle over to the right. And if I were then really lucky, I could put it together and I could animate them. And there's my bunny running through the grass. That's my great PowerPoint trick for the day, okay? So this is as good as it gets. Okay, so here, one more time. Here's our bunny running through the grass. Oh, one more time, all right. There's your bunny, okay. So today what we're gonna do is we're going to try to automate the process of producing these cells. We won't quite get to the point of being able to put them all together, but we're gonna try to automate the process of generating this sequence. And this is much of what animation today is like. That is, you don't do things necessarily by drawing everything by hand, but use a computer to automate parts of that process. Okay, so let me switch over now to our CS50 IDE. And I have created for us, and let me zoom in here a little bit. I've created for us a starting point. Every time that we ask you to sit down and write a piece of code, what we're really asking you to do is we're asking you to solve a problem. And the way that you should think about doing that is by starting with some simple part of that solution and then build out from that part. And that's what we're going to do today. So rather than trying all at once to write the entire bunch of code that's going to produce those 10 animation cells, we're going to start instead with one piece that works, and then we'll build a little bit around that and a little more and a little more. Now, the good thing about solving problems this way is that it'll allow you to start always with something that you know works and introduce one gradual change. And that's a great way to learn how to code, because each time you make a change, you see what impact it has. Okay, so here's our starting point. Okay, so at the beginning of my file, I've hash included standard IO. That's so that I can get the printf function to work. I then have my main function. And this still looks a little arcane or obscure to some of you. That's okay. All it says is that the main function takes no arguments. Void means nothing in C. And it returns, by convention, an integer. Main always returns an integer, usually a code saying things went well or didn't go well. Okay, but main has to have that form for us right now. I then put in three lines of code, and along with each line of code, I've put a comment. Now, one of the things that we will insist that you do, and it's such an important programming practice, is to always comment your code. Always write down, in an English comment, something that you think the code is supposed to do. That way, later on, when you come back to it, you can look at it and you can say, oh, I remember what I was trying to do with this. Or when a TA sits down with you to try to help you at office hours, they can look at this and go, I see what you were trying to do, but instead, this is what's really happening. Okay? So I've got three parts to my code. I'm going to, first of all, print out some dots at the start. I'll then print out my extremely fancy bunny. And then some bit of dots at the end. And these three print statements should look familiar to you at this point. Okay? All that I'm doing in each of them is I'm printing out a sequence of characters. There's no variables involved. Everything is just flat. Okay, so if I go down now to my terminal, let's see if I can get this back out. And I'm going to type clear again.
Can we use the double slash to comment?
Can you use the double? Yes. There's multiple ways to leave comments in C. One way is to use the double slash. The other is to use a slash and a star, and then close with a star and a slash. Okay. All right, so I'm going to, first of all, I'm going to start navigating around here. So if I go to my home directory, I've changed directories there. I'm going to look and see what's in that directory, ls list out. I'm going to see that I've got two subdirectories. Oh, we're gonna, let's make this a little bigger here so that we can all see it. I can see that I've got two subdirectories. I'll change directory to go into workspace, and I'm going to only type out part of it and then just hit tab, and it'll complete the rest for me. Fancy. I'll look and see in workspace, and right now I'm working on the super section that we're teaching right now, so I'll go into that directory. And finally look and see, and I've got that file bunny.c. All right, so let me clear once more. And I'm going to now, again, I'm still staying in that directory, and it's telling me I'm in that super section directory. I'm going to go ahead and make my program bunny. And that command, make bunny, while sounding a little bit odd, also invokes the Clang compiler. And it's produced for me an output that is an executable funny, an executable file called bunny. Okay, I can then, and this sounds even worse, execute bunny. Okay, and let's see what it does. Okay, that's a little bit of what I was expecting. I've got my bunny picture in there, but I kind of wanted it all by itself. What did I miss? Slash n, okay. So let's go back out here, and I'll get out of that, and I'll go back into this one. And let's take a look now from my main function here. So what should I do? I want to end the line. So I'll put in a comment. I'll put in a printf. And what do I have to put in? Slash n. Okay. What do I have to end it with? Semicolon. All right. Now, one of the really important things is make sure every time you make a change in your code that you save it. If you haven't saved your code, you're going to notice a little star up there. And that star says you haven't saved this code. If I compile it right now, it's not going to reflect any of those changes because the compiler looks at the file that's on the disk, not the file that's open in your editor. All right, so let's save it. And then we'll go right on down here. Come back out. Come down to my terminal. And let's clear the space again. And we can go ahead and one more time make our bunny program and execute the bunny. That didn't work either. Wrong slash. So if you look at what I've got, I put a slash n in there, but I had the wrong slash. Everything that your computer does is very explicit. Okay? One little mistake of punctuation, and suddenly you don't get what you want. All right, so let's zoom back out again. We'll go back. We'll make that very quick repair. We'll put the right slash in. We'll save it. We'll zoom back in. For some reason that's not being happy, but let's go ahead and we'll go back to the terminal here. Clear it up. We'll zoom in, and one more time we'll make bunny, and now, sure enough, it works. Hooray. Okay, so let's try to make this a little more general. Let's see if instead of just printing one particular frame, let's see if we can make this so that we can get all 10 of those animated frames that we wanted to have. So again, let's take this a step at a time. Let's first generalize it, not so that I do all the frames, but so I do any one frame that I might want. So what's the difference between the frames? Is the bunny the same? Yeah, what's the difference? It's position, right? And how do I control its position? How many dots I'm putting at the beginning and how many dots I'm putting at the end. So I had 5 at the beginning and 5 at the end. Let's replace that 5 with a for loop. Okay? And I'm going to create a for loop now that's going to say I'm going to print some number of dots at the beginning. I'm going to use a variable, let's say, how about I, as the counter in my loop, and I'm going to declare it up top. And then in the for loop, I need to do three things. The first thing I need to do is I need to initialize I. What should I initialize it to start to be? Zero, okay? Then I need to say, what's the termination condition? When should I stop? Well, how many dots do you want to print on this one? Five again? How about let's do something different? We did five. Let's show that it's different. Two, okay. So what should I, if I want two dots, what should I put here? Three, okay. How many times is that going to go through? Well, that's going to go through three times, zero, one, and two, right? All right, let's go back down to two. Now we'll get two dots. And what do I want to do each time I go through the loop? What has to change each time I go through? I have to keep going. I'm going to add a dot. I'm going to print a dot each time through the loop. But how am I keeping track of how many times I've been through the loop? I'm using I, that variable, that counter. So every time through, I'm going to increment the counter by one. Now that's the same for me as saying I equals I plus one. That's okay, I could do it that. I like the shorthand, so I'm going to say I plus plus. Okay? Let's do the same thing down here at the bottom. Only I kind of did that one. I'm going to let you guys do this one completely. All right, so what should I write here? Here's my for loop. I'm going to do a printf. And I'm going to make it so that I only print one dot on that bottom. What should I write inside this for loop now? Well, first of all, what variable should I use? I could use J. Can I use the same one? Can I use I again? Yeah, that's okay. Because the I's that I'm using up here, I don't need them again when I get down to this point. So what should I initialize I to? Zero. What should I check? How many dots do I need now at the end if I've got two dots at the beginning? I need eight at the end. So what should I check? I less than? I heard seven, I heard eight, and I heard nine. Okay, so we're all in the right ball. Jason says 10, okay? If I needed two dots for the first one, how many do I, and I need eight dots for the last one, I put a two up above, what should I put down below? Eight. Because that's going to count zero through seven, and that's eight times through the loop. Okay, and what do I have to do at the end? I plus plus. All right. So that's looking pretty good there. Let's try it, and let's see what it does. Okay? So we're going to save it, okay, nice and saved. We'll zoom back out. We'll try here in the terminal. We'll zoom in. Oops. We'll one more time make our bunny program and go ahead and execute bunny. And there it is. So there's our bunny where it has two dots at the beginning and eight dots out at the end. Everybody still with me? Okay. So we built it up. We built one bunny, one particular frame. Now we've been able to generalize that to build more different kinds of frames. Now let's go ahead and have it generate not just one frame, but let's generate 10 frames where we slowly make the bunny move all the way across the field. All right. Let's go back, and we'll try now. So what do I really need to change here? What do I need to change?
Well, first you need to change the number of dots maximum at the beginning. Because it's neat. If we're doing 10 dots, it's going to need to be up
to. Yeah, so right now I have it sort of hardwired to always do two dots at the beginning. and always do 8 dots at the end. I want to build another loop, right? Because I don't want to build just one bunny picture. I want to build 10 bunny pictures. So I need to build another loop, and as I go through that loop, I want to change how many dots I print at the beginning and how many dots I print at the end based on which cycle through the loop I'm in. All right, so let's get another counter. Somebody's before said J, so we'll make another J. And now we're going to build another for loop. What goes inside that loop? This stuff has to go inside the loop, right? Does the bunny have to go inside the loop? Do I need a bunny in each of those 10 frames? Yeah, I want a bunny in each of the 10 frames, right? How about the dots at the end? Do I need that? Okay, so I'm going to indent all of them. I'm going to highlight all of this, and I'm going to hit Tab, and that's going to push them all over a little bit so that it's easy for me to see what's in the loop. And then I'll end it, let's say. Okay? Now, in this loop that I'm building, whoops, make that so you can see, I've got my counter J. I'll start it at 0. How many times do I want to go through this loop? 10 times. So what number should I put here? 9, 10, somebody's got to say 11, right? I wanted 2 dots before and I put I less than 2. I wanted 8 dots, I put I less than 8. Now I want to go through 10 times, so I put J less than 10. There we go. And what do I do at the end to J? Plus plus, increment it. Okay. Now, here's the tricky part. What's going to happen right now if I do this? Am I going to print 10 frames? They'll all be the same, right? Because all of them are still going to put 2 dots at the beginning. But I don't want them all to have 2 dots at the beginning. How many dots do I want at the beginning? I want it to change, right? So what do I have here that's changing each time the loop goes through? J, the number of dots. So I can change this to be J. The first time through the loop, what's that going to be? What do I set J to at first? 0. So how many times am I going to do this? 0. The second time through the loop, J is going to be 1 because I increment it. How many dots am I going to print? 1. The third time through the loop, how many dots am I going to print? J is going to be 3. How many dots am I going to print? Or sorry, J is going to be 2. How many dots am I going to print? 2. Okay, so I'm going to keep incrementing that as we go along. How about down below? What goes down here? I don't want 8 always at the end anymore. I want 10 dots? I want it to change 2. So how do I want it to change? Well, if I have 5 dots at the beginning, how many dots do I get at the end? If I have 6 dots at the beginning, how many do I get at the end? If I got 7 dots at the beginning, how many do I get at the end? If I've got J dots at the beginning, how many do I get at the end? 10 minus J. Okay. So let's try that out. So I'm going to save our bunny program. Once again, we'll zoom out. We'll go down to our terminal, clear it, and zoom in. We'll make our bunny program again, and we'll execute it. Uh-oh. Hold on, let's zoom out. Did I get 10 frames? Well, how many bunnies do I see up there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I got 10 frames. Are they all the same? No. That first one, the bunny is far on the left. And over here, the bunny is far on the... So what did I forget to do? I forgot to start a new line again. Same mistake I made before. All right, let's go fix that. Now, I've still got the code in there to make a new line. Why didn't it work? Oh, it's not inside the loop. That's right. It's sitting outside here. And the for loop is everything that's inside that text. So I'm going to move this inside the for loop, and I'll tab in front of it to show that it's in the right place. And now we'll save it again. We'll zoom out. We'll switch over to our terminal. Zoom in. We'll remake our bunny program. And now we've got our 10 frames. Okay. So, here's our nested for loops. We were able to generate in the inner loop how many dots I wanted to print at the beginning, at the end. And the outer loop controlled how many frames I was building. We started with one little kernel of the problem, and we built out from that point. All right, let's do one more step. You ready? There's one thing in here where we've actually kind of got more complexity than we need. Let's take a look. So in our bunny program, if I zoom out here, I actually do some of the same thing over and over again. What do I do that's sort of the same thing repeated twice? Yeah, I print those dots twice. Really, I should have this comment down here. I print some dots at the beginning, right up here, and then I print some dots at the end, and I do kind of exactly the same thing. What we're going to start working on in the next few weeks is being able to take those blocks of code that we use over and over again, and through a process called abstraction, we're going to pull them out and write them once so that we can then reuse them over and over again. So let's try that. Ready? We're going to take this block of code, and I'm going to take it out of there, and I'm going to define down at the bottom, I'm going to write a new function. It's not going to return anything, and I'm going to call it print dots. It's going to take one argument, an integer, that says how many dots I should print. Okay? And now, instead of printing j dots, I'll tell how many dots I should print. And there's one little problem here. Anybody know what it is? What do I have that's listed in here that's not defined? Well, how many dots is defined right up here, but I'm using that variable I. So I'm going to take that variable I and I'm going to define it down in here instead. So now it's going to stay, oops, got the caps lock on somehow. I'm going to keep I down in here. So now here's my little function or subroutine. And it says, how many dots am I going to print? And it'll go through this loop and print them over and over again. I can then modify my program up here. And what did I call that function? Print dots. So I'll call print dots. How many dots do I want to print the first time before the bunny? J. How many dots do I want to print at the end after the bunny? 10 minus J. And there's one thing I'm missing. As you saw in lecture today, we're going to declare print dots up above. To give the prototype. Okay. So what I've done is I've tried to isolate that reused part of code that I've done over and over again. And I've tried to pull it out so that all of that is contained in one place. That way, if I have a mistake somewhere, I only have to fix it in one spot. All right, so let's save it and let's make sure it works. So let's go out, We'll go again to our terminal. We'll zoom in. We'll make that bunny process. Oh, and it's giving me a warning. What is it telling me? Well, in any of these times, you always want to scroll up to the very first error. Now, in this one, I've only got one. It tells me in bunny.c, on line 8, column 9, there's a problem. It says you've declared this variable I and you haven't used it. Now, normally, that's not the worst error. That's an easy one to fix. And in fact, we can go back in. We can go back to bunny. And in this case, all we have to do is get rid of I, because we're not using I within main anymore. We're just using it within our subroutine. So let's save that. We'll go back and zoom in. We'll one more time make bunny. And there again are our 10 frames. Okay. Anytime you're given a procedure. Yep.
I'm confused. Can you go back to the code?
Yep.
So when you wrote your prototype, the argument you had it named was called how many, but below you.
Oh, yeah. Why are they different? So that's a great question. So in the question was, up here, I wrote how many, and down below, I wrote how many dots. The reason is that up in your prototype, it's actually not paying attention to the names that you're putting in. All it really cares about is that it's an integer. It wants to know the form of what you're putting in. Now, stylistically, whoops, what I should do is I like to make these match, okay? Because that'll keep it easier for me to remember. But that was my mistake. Yeah.
And so for the prototype to work, does the writing that line, writing the prototype, allows that function that comes right below to go to the end and retrieve what that means?
What it means is, when the compiler goes through, it goes from the top of your code to the bottom. And what this prototype is it's basically a promise. It says, there's going to be a function defined somewhere. It's going to be called printDots. And it's going to take one argument that's going to be an integer, and it's going to return nothing, void type. Okay? I promise you, it's going to be defined somewhere down the road. But anytime you see that, as you go down through the rest of my main function, I want you to treat that as a function that takes one integer input. And so when the compiler goes down through this, it sees that promise. And when it gets down, keeps going, it finds the first time printDots is mentioned. And it says, oh, you're giving me this j. J is an integer. Well, you promised me that that would be an integer, and that's right. That's okay. And then finally, down at the very bottom, before I get to the end of my file, I make good on my promise, and I define it. Okay?
So it saves, the program will save blank spaces that it goes back and fills at the end?
It's not about the memory allocation. It's actually just about what type are you expecting to see. Should this thing have one argument or five arguments? Should it have integers be given to it or strings? That's all it's looking to do, is to check, are you giving me this the right kind of argument? Okay. All right, let me leave you with one other bit to look at. ASCII art is not the great model of animation as it is today. But some people, of course, take things and they push it to their extremes. This is, as David demonstrated in lecture, a piece of code that you should under no circumstances try to duplicate yourselves, because it is terrible stylistically. In fact, it is designed to be as difficult as possible to read. Okay, so to do again, let's zoom in here. I'm going to go now change directory. I'm going to go up one level back to my workspace. I'll then change directory into this other directory that I've created. And this is the International Obfuscated C Programming Contest. Obfuscated means as hard as possible to understand. So please don't be scared if you look at this and go, I can't read that. That's the point of it, okay? But we have this wonderful program that I'm gonna look at by just typing more. And let's see if I can zoom out just a bit so you can see it. And this is the program. It's named endo.c. And it looks like this bucket with kind of the letters F-L-U-I-D in it. This is actually a program. It's written in the most obscure way that the authors could possibly write it. But it's a wonderful little piece that generates a model of fluid dynamics. And so we're going to give that model an input that looks like this, of a stared set of containers with some fluid, some liquid up at the top, and we'll have it simulate what's happening to it. So I'll call that function, endo, and I'll give it that input file that I've had, and there is our epitome of ASCII art, a full fluid dynamics simulator running in just a few lines of code. Now, what's actually really amazing about this little program is that I want to stop it now, so I'm going to use what command? Control-C. Okay, so I'll use Control-C. That'll stop it. I'll clear again. And now I'm going to invoke the program, execute the program, using itself as input. And we'll see the fluid dynamic simulation of it melting. Okay. Please don't let that program be the thing that confuses you. It's just so that we can end on something cool and interesting. Okay. Best of luck with your problem sets. We'll be happy to answer questions after class. Thanks much, guys.